All right. We do this lesson. Thank you. We do this lesson almost always exclusively for men. That doesn't mean that it's only men that need the lesson, but we find out that it seems to be a more predominantly driven issue by men than it is by women. Obviously, as we're talking about affairs in relationships, it really doesn't exist without both a man and a woman being involved. And if it does, then we really have another lesson we need to add to this one anyway. It's the kind of thing that seems to be at least more directed or focused by men. Not in that they are more guilty, but that if they take the proper leadership role in the relationship, that they can normally be the ones more successful at preventing some kind of extramarital relationship. And we call it affair-proofing your marriage just because that's the way we talk about it in today's society. Not a big fan of the word. The affair just makes it sound much more gentle than what it should sound in our minds. I mean, it clearly is an adulterous relationship, an extramarital infidelity. You can think of a lot of different words that would describe it better than affair, but the lesson's just a title of affair because that's what we have grown accustomed to hearing it as in our society. How many of you would recognize that? What is that? Anybody know what that is? Not what is it describing, but what is it? I'm sorry, what? It is a type of cancer. This actually is a breast cancer, infiltrating ductal carcinoma. And then there's a lot of information about that. It tells you that they examined what they call a complete excision of the tumor here. And they give a tumor size, a histological type, a score, which helps them understand the significance or seriousness of it, the extent of invasion, whether or not there's any margins involved in the sample that they took out. Estrogen receptor positive, progesterone receptor positive, those are both favorable things because of treatment, things of that nature. But all of this composed, all of this together combined, is called a pathology report. We've probably all had pathology reports about something. They draw your blood, they do a pathology report. Whether they're examining cholesterol, when they do a blood examination and check cholesterol and triglycerides and things like that, the doctor gets back from the lab a pathology report. What's the purpose of a pathology report? So first they have to determine if anything is wrong. So the doctor gets this back, and it tells him there was definitely something wrong. This was a malignant tumor, and he knows it was a malignant tumor, and he knows certain characteristics of the malignant tumor. So the pathology report does what for him? Not only helps with diagnosis, helps with treatment. It allows the doctor to understand, if this is what I'm dealing with, then this is the way I need to approach it. This is the way I need to seek to solve the problem. That's exactly the way we want to deal with this subject this afternoon. We want to deal with what we're going to call the pathology of an affair, the pathology of this extramarital relationship. What is it that causes it to happen? What is it that you're looking at if you're going to know how it is that you're going to prevent it or treat it in a marriage relationship? And so there ends up being a four-step destructive process that's involved in extramarital affairs. Almost always are all four of these steps included within that relationship. Well, let's just see. See, I'm just telling you, this thing does not... Oh, there we go. It worked. After he ran all the way upstairs, it worked. Vulnerability is a big factor here. Putting yourself in a position to where something can happen. And there are a lot of different things that cause vulnerability, things that make us more likely, more subject to get involved in something that we shouldn't get involved in. Whether we're talking here about extramarital relationships or any sinful behavior, vulnerability makes a difference. If you are greatly aggravated at work, because things have gone very badly at work, when you come home, there is a much stronger chance you're going to say or do something in response to your wife or your children that you might not normally do. Why? Because you're vulnerable. Something else has affected you. We understand that. That's the way that it works. If you're very tired, you might say something that you wouldn't say if you weren't as tired, if you're very hungry. There are a lot of things that make us vulnerable to different things, different temptations. I love the quote from Peggy Vaughn. It says, "Preventing affairs is not like having a one-time inoculation or even getting occasional booster shots. It's more like taking a pill every day for the rest of your life." There is a subjectivity to falling. God tells us that. Think of some of the things that make us vulnerable. What are some things that make us vulnerable to sinful behavior? Might make us vulnerable particularly to some kind of extramarital relationship. I mean, some of them are listed there in your books. I mean, if you're under a lot of stress, you may find yourself more vulnerable. If you're grieving some kind of major loss, you're feeling insecure and looking for affirmation. I can tell you that happens considerably. I've got a family member that got involved in an extramarital relationship. And when she describes what happened in her life, it was, I didn't feel that I was being emotionally supported at home. I was looking for some kind of emotional support. Somebody came into her life that appeared to be very emotionally supporting, not striving to get her to have a relationship, but just somebody that said, you know what, I understand what you feel. They sympathize. So you got a male sympathizing with a female, talking about those kind of things. You got somebody that's vulnerable, looking for affirmation. They got affirmation. It led to things way beyond what it should have. There are a lot of things. Sometimes not only do we feel insecure, not only are we looking for affirmation, we might find ourselves feeling rejected. We're looking for some kind of approval from somebody, and it has that effect on us. Think of some other things. Other things that make us vulnerable. I'm sorry, what? Oh, absolutely. Peer pressure. I mean, some of the things that are going on around us, things that people are saying, watching the behavior, the actions of the people around us, make us more vulnerable. God understands that. He tells us in 1 Corinthians 15, who you're with and what they're doing make a big difference in life, doesn't it? He doesn't say, you know what, there's a slight danger of evil companions having a bad effect on you. He states it much more matter-of-factly, doesn't he? Evil companionship is going to corrupt good. He just said, just count on it. There's sometimes we have this mentality, we're strong enough that we're going to overcome evil all the time. God says, just be aware. It's not the way it normally works. It's more likely to work the other way. Other things that make us vulnerable. Anger, no question about that. When we are angry at one person, we are much more likely to do one of two things. Sometimes take it out on somebody else. We're vulnerable that way. But sometimes to look for the comfort of somebody else. What else? It's interesting, some of the statistics that are regarding extramarital relationships, you realize that the majority of extramarital relationships when men are interviewed is not because they are dissatisfied with their relationship at home. Isn't that kind of strange? Wouldn't you think that it was not even dissatisfied with the sexual side of the relationship at home? That is not the majority. That represents about 40, I think it was 42% of the men say that is a major factor. But 72% say that looking for excitement because I'm bored is a major factor. It's not that I'm dissatisfied with you in particular. I'm just looking for something different. We hear things like what? The grass is greener on the other side of the fence. I loved one man quote that I read. He said, you know, the grass is greener where it's watered. I thought, man, that's a valid point. Water the grass at home, the grass at home will be much greener. Other things that make us vulnerable. Being alone. Is that what you said, being alone? Absolutely. And as you, not only being alone, just you alone, sometimes being alone in a situation that you shouldn't be in. I remember when Judy and I started dating. I'd only been a Christian just a short while. Her mother passed away after our first date, so her mother was no longer at home. So it's just her dad at home, and I would go over there to visit at her house. And her dad would say, because he went to work like at 5 in the morning, so he got up at around 4:30 or whatever to go to work at 5 in the morning. I was the other way. I was a very late night, and so I'd be over at the house. He'd get up to go to bed at 8:30. He'd say, well, we'll see you tomorrow, Mark. And I'm thinking, it's only 8:30. You know, and he says, well, if I'm going to bed, you're leaving the house. And I have to tell you, I thought, this guy doesn't trust me any farther than he can throw me. I'm thinking, this really hurts that he feels that. That wasn't even the issue. It wasn't an issue of trusting me particularly. It was an issue of trusting the situation. And he understood, I'm not making the provision for or allowing that kind of thing to happen. So aloneness is certainly one of those things. Other things. How about not being aware of your weakness? Sometimes we're just not aware of our weakness. God tells us through Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he says, you know what, you can be a little overconfident. We understand that in sports, don't we? You ever heard anybody talk about a team that lost because they had already counted on the win? They just knew they were going to win. They weren't prepared, and so they lost. God says, be careful. Take heed. If you think you stand firm, take heed, he says, because you're likely to fall, lest you fall. There are a lot of things that make us vulnerable. Dave Carter, who has written a couple exceptional books on this concept, said in his book, Torn Asunder, when we are vulnerable, we're emotionally run down. Our defenses are down. Our perspective on things is clouded. We're not able to make judgments based on truth, and everything is seen through an emotional filter. Pain is intensified. Therefore, the pursuit of relief from pain is also intensified. When you are vulnerable, a situation that might otherwise be safe may now be unsafe. That's the difference between vulnerability. He says, if you're vulnerable, what might have been safe yesterday when you were not feeling that way may not be safe today. Secondly, there becomes not only vulnerability, but there becomes an emotional involvement. This is the natural step. There's vulnerability first. There's an emotional involvement second. The emotional involvement is that which we feel pretty safe with. You know, because people tend to say that nothing is going on when there's no physical contact, they feel safe. They think because they're still walking within the boundary. When actually they've already crossed the line. There's this tendency to think, you know what, we're not physically involved. Nobody's touched each other. Nobody's talked about touching each other. None of that. And so there's a safety or a feeling of safety that shouldn't be felt. There's an emotional involvement, and it shows itself in different ways. And if we're not careful, it allows us to experience things at a level that we shouldn't experience them. And there are a couple of things that help us to understand that. Dr. Shirley Glass talks about three things that help us to understand some signs that say you've crossed the line from what is proper into infidelity. You've now crossed that line. It doesn't take the committing of the sexual act to have gone farther than you should have gone. God tells us that there are things that we need to bring into captivity that are thoughts. Isn't that what he says? Bring every thought into captivity. The idea Jesus said, here's part of the problem with the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 5 and some of the Jews in general. But Jesus wasn't comparing the old law to what he was teaching. He was comparing what they thought the old law was to what God's truth was. He said, you say you shall not commit adultery. But I say, he says, you know, this is what you've heard. You've heard it said, not it is written, you shall not commit adultery. You've heard it said as if that's the only thing that was forbidden. But I'm telling you, if you lust after a woman, you've already committed adultery. He's not saying, you know what, under the old law, it was okay to lust. But we're changing under my law, you can't lust. That wasn't the point. He's saying, you never could lust. But you guys are only focused on the act. And I'm telling you, there's more involved than that, than just the act itself. And so you can't lust. She says emotional intimacy is the first of those steps. Sharing information about yourself or about your marriage with somebody of the opposite sex, things that you shouldn't say, maybe information about your personal struggles that you're having in your relationship. That's one thing for me to sit down with a male friend and talk about some of the struggles I'm having. That is a totally different thing for me to have a friend who is a woman that I'm setting up that kind of emotional tie with, having that kind of an emotional discussion. Sharing intimate issues, talking about our marital problems, those kinds of things. Wanting some kind of support structure. I'm looking to help somebody, to protect them, or I'm looking to be protected by somebody when it's the opposite sex. Here are some things that were said by spouses to somebody of the opposite sex. These are just not appropriate conversations. One lady said, my husband and I are really having problems. How is your marriage doing? Now, talking to her friend as a girl, that may be one thing. But for a woman to talk to a man and say, man, we're just really having troubles. How about you? How's your marriage going? Well, what happens if his isn't going too well? Now, we've opened up a connection that we never should have even opened up. One man said, my wife doesn't take care of herself anymore. You look like you really are interested in taking care of yourself. There's no benefit in that kind of comment. Male to female, we're in a society sometimes where we act like those relationships should be equal. You know, I can have relationships with women, I can have relationships with men. It really shouldn't be that way. My husband takes me for granted. You make me feel very special. That was a woman talking to her boss. Where do you think that led? That led to an extramarital relationship. Whether it was that statement, that's where that relationship eventually went. And she talks about that. It's interesting to go through Dave Carter's book, Torn Asunder, or Dave Carter's book, Close Calls. Both good books dealing with how people have told you how they got where they were going and how that was brought about. And so what happens is we get that emotional intimacy. Secondly, sexual tension. There's a tension there. There's a feeling that changes. Tell me some things that would indicate sexual tension. Indicators of sexual tension. Man and a woman are feeling a tension that shouldn't be there. How do you know that? Long look, no question about that. It's all of a sudden you realize we don't look at each other the way that I look at each other with all my other employers or employees or somebody or my other friends. You notice there's that lingering look and a thought process that goes with that. Other things? Absolutely. Flirtatious comments is a way of releasing sexual tension. That's why we say those kinds of things. So if a person is very flirtatious, it's creating a tension issue. And if they're not already a tension, sometimes a flirtatious comment creates the sexual tension. And so you find yourself in an environment. How do I respond to that? What exactly was their intent? What do they mean? Other things. Absolutely. And I can tell you that's a great example. I had a young lady at the congregation where I was preaching on one occasion who was that kind. She was just one of those people that smiled at everybody. Very vivacious, drove her husband crazy because he thought she was flirting with everybody. I don't think she was. I never think that was their intent. But she was that kind of person. She came up to me on one occasion, and she was talking to me. She was one of those people that would put their hand on your shoulder like that. She was talking to me. She put her hand on my shoulder, and she was just rubbing my shoulder like that. And this is at the building, too. So now I got double issues. But I told her. I said... I got her away from the other people that were right there. I said, I'm not telling you had any intent at all. I don't think you had any intent. Please don't misunderstand what I'm going to say, but that can't happen. That can't happen again. My wife would not be comfortable with that. I'm not comfortable with that. That just creates a tension that is not a good tension. We're a touchy-feely society. We'll talk a little bit about that in the solution to that as well. Those are things that show us that there's sexual tension. With men, sexual tension sometimes can be noticed because there are physiological changes in us. We understand that. Sometimes we are mentally stimulated by the look of somebody, and it creates a tension that wouldn't have been there otherwise. We need to certainly be concerned about that. Thirdly, secrecy. You cannot have secrecy between a husband and wife. I saw a book the other day that was 101 Things I Wish I Knew Before I Got Married. One of the chapters is Secrecy is Lies. I thought that was kind of an interesting title. But that's basically what it is. Anything that you keep deceptively away from somebody, we need to be open books. The openness that is talked about in Genesis chapter 2 when it talks about they were naked and not ashamed, that's portraying a complete openness before somebody, a complete transparency. There's nothing that I should be holding from my wife as secrets. That if I've got a secret about some other thing that happened or some relationship or something that I'm doing, then I have already crossed that line. Then thirdly, in the relationship itself, there's physical involvement. It goes from emotional involvement to physical involvement. That's not a difficult one to deal with. We understand the nature of that. Once a relationship becomes physical, it's hard to get out of. It's like a full-blown addiction. Why is it like a full-blown addiction? Why is it so hard to get away from a physical relationship? Man, it does. We need to understand that. When God said, and the two shall become one, God intended that there be a bond created through the sexual union. A bond that exists between two people that doesn't exist without that. And so Jesus, you remember on one occasion said, do you not know that the one who joins himself to a harlot, what? Becomes one with the harlot. Same exact description of what happens between you and your wife. He says he becomes one. There's a bonding. It isn't just that there was a sexual act. He said those two have now bonded in a different fashion, and so it creates that. Secondly, there's another reason why it's so hard to walk away from a physical relationship. pleasurable, isn't it? There's an excitement level, there's a pleasurability level, and God intended it to be that as well. He intended the sexual act to be that way. He's the one that made it pleasurable. He's the one that, it doesn't matter if it's your wife or somebody else, your body releases the same exact hormones, creates the same pleasurable effect in your body. We understand that even scientifically. And if it does that, then it's going to make it harder to walk away from something that has that pleasurability. Physical involvement is a step that's very difficult to walk away from. And then finally, rationalization is the last. It is hard to imagine how some people have justified their situation. I just want you to listen to a few of these. These are actual statements made when people confronted about their adulterous relationship. One said, I had just determined just one more time. How many people said, just one more time, and then I got to break this off, whatever it is. One man said, if my wife only met my needs, I wouldn't do this. So now I'm excused for doing that. That's kind of like the butt apology. You know, we just had a lesson in the last retreat we did on 10 apologies that you ought to be sorry for. And that's one of them. You know, the apology with caveat. You know what? I'm sorry, but if you didn't make me so angry, well, too late now. I'm sorry, period. Don't say anything else. It's I'm sorry, period. That's the same kind of thing. You know what? I would have never done this if, sounds kind of like Adam, doesn't it? Sounds kind of like Eve. You know, everybody wants to blame somebody. The serpent, he's the one that called me. Adam says, this woman that you gave me, I'd have never been eating this fruit if you hadn't given me this woman. There's justification. You know, we watch that in our kids, don't we? We've got three boys. Never, ever did I walk in because the boys had been in a fight and say to one of the boys, you know what? What happened? And one brother says, he hit me. And so I say, did you hit him? I don't recall ever one of the sons saying, yes, I did. I am profoundly sorry for that. I had no justification for doing that at all. Please forgive me. Took to his brother and said, please forgive me. It never. There's always a justification, a rationalization. Yes, I did because, and there's always a reason for it. Rationalization becomes a part of that. I understand her so much better than her husband does. I mean, some of the rationalizations are worse than others, but they're still rationalizations. She needs me. I'm just too weak is another one. No one else knows what's the harm. That's a Christian's rationalization. It's scary, some of the things that are said, but we look to rationalize. One said, God will forgive us. You want to know my rationalization for what I can get forgiveness for this. You know, we used to joke about that sometimes, but it wasn't a joking matter. The idea of easier to get forgiveness than it is permission. You know, that was kind of a mentality we had sometimes as kids. Easier to get forgiveness than it is permission. It doesn't work that way. I can't approach it thinking God will forgive me for this. And so how is it we're going to overcome? How is it we're going to win the battle? If that's the pathology of an affair, then how do we prevent it? And we're going to see four steps. I just want you to consider a passage first, and then we're going to turn to one after that. I want you to consider 2 Samuel chapter 11. That's a passage of David and Bathsheba. Probably we can recall enough from that story that we shouldn't have to turn to it. But David made several mistakes that fall exactly into this pattern here. There are certain things that David did that show exactly where he was in this pattern, this pathology. Tell me some of the things that David did. Mistakes that David made. He looked upon her, and I'll get to that in a second. I heard somebody else. What else? Yeah, we don't know why, but it says, at a time when kings were at war, David wasn't. He was at home. You know, sometimes we say we fault David for being up on the roof. It wasn't being up on the roof that was the issue. I don't think there's anything in the passage that indicates David went up on the roof with bad motives. So I'll just give him the credit. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt there. David was innocently on the roof. If I give him the benefit of the doubt there, that's not the issue. David, it says, he saw Bathsheba or saw a woman bathing or saw her naked. Every man understands the context of that statement, don't you? Every man understands, I don't care who you are, that has an impact on you. You see a woman naked, it has an impact, and you have to make a decision as to what you're going to do. And so David did what? David immediately averted his eyes? No. David gazed upon her. He saw her naked. He gazed upon her. He looked upon her. So he puts himself now in an area of vulnerability. He saw something. How many of you in here would say, you know what? I've seen things before that I didn't want to see and wasn't ready to see. Has that ever happened to you? I mean, that's happened to probably anybody that's been on the internet at some point or another. Something came up, or maybe you've been in a movie. We went and saw a movie one time that was rated PG, and so you think you're perfectly safe with PG except for maybe a little bit of language, and the next thing you know, somebody's standing in front of the screen and their breasts are exposed. You know, and it's a PG movie. Did not expect it at all, but the MPAA has decided that for artistic reasons that you can show breast in a PG movie. That does not require a PG-13 rating if it is used in an artistic rather than a sexual manner is the way it reads. You know, the MPAA, you realize, is just a group. I think it's 27 people or 17 people that just watch a movie and make their own determination. There are no rules. You know, sometimes we think if you say this word, you automatically get this rating. Absolutely not true. There are no specific rules. They have to judge based on what they think the intent of the content is as well. But sometimes we see things. Other things that David did. Not only did he gaze upon her, what did he do next? Sent somebody to find out who she was. Inquired. Who is this woman? I saw this beautiful woman bathing on the roof. I was just absolutely taken by her. And so I want to find out who is this woman. And he was the king, so he certainly could make that kind of inquiry, and people would do that for him, wouldn't they? So he's going to inquire. And what did he find out? This is the wife of Uriah. This is the wife of Uriah. And so David said, you know what? I better back off. This just doesn't work. Is that what he did? No, David just keeps falling into the mistakes, doesn't he? He sends for her, almost as if he's just going to talk to her. You know, let's just talk a little bit. Let's just get together. He sends for her. He ends up having the relationship with her and watches not only his life, but his family's life and his descendants' life considerably down the road. He watches that just absolutely fall apart at the prophecy of God. There are going to be things that are going to happen to David that cause him great pain in all of this. Think about the opposite side of that story. You got Joseph in Genesis chapter 39. There is a man dealing with sexual temptation. He reminds me of a quote by Mark Twain that I always thought was interesting. Mark Twain said, there are many ways to deal with or to handle temptation. He says, cowardice may be the best of them. I thought that's a great idea. Just, you know what? Put your tail between your legs and run as fast as you can. That's God's advice too, isn't it? He says, flee youthful lust. Flee fornication. He says, I don't care how strong you think you are, you better turn and run as fast as you can. Joseph did. And you think that wasn't hard for Joseph? What do you think? Potiphar's wife. She's probably a real dog, wasn't she? Not thinking so. You didn't get in Potiphar's position in that time any more than that happens today. Potiphar was a powerful man. His wife was probably a very good-looking woman. And she's pressing on Joseph every day, day after day after day after day, lay with me. Until finally she grabs a hold of him one time. And he just, you know what? I can't even answer the question this time. Can't even say no. I'm going to have to just run as fast as I can. She keeps the coat. Joseph suffers a lot of problem for that, but no problems with God, did he? Suffered a lot of physical problems, but he suffered no problems with God in all of that. I want you to turn to Proverbs chapter 7, because here comes a description of both the problem and the solution detailed for us. Proverbs chapter 7. And I want you to look at this and see that it is, see if it's not exactly the kind of thing where God is saying, just watch this vulnerability. Just watch this emotional tie that becomes a physical relationship that has rationalization behind all of it. It's like a picture of the pathology that we're describing. For at the window of my house, verse 6, for at the window of my house, I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths a young man devoid of understanding. Think of the vulnerability issue there. He says, you know what? That's one of the things that makes you vulnerable. Sometimes we just don't know. We don't know the things that will affect us. We don't know the things that we should be doing, the ways that we should avoid them. Sometimes we just don't know. And this man didn't know. He says, I see this guy down there, and I'm just telling you, he doesn't understand where he is headed. He does not perceive the danger in this. That's a hard lesson sometimes to teach your children, isn't it? I'm not talking about just in a relationship like a something as far as an extramarital relationship or premarital relationship. I'm saying just in general with your kids. Those that have raised children, especially past teenage years, hard sometimes to convince them of areas that are inherently dangerous. Things that can certainly present great danger. And those of you that are young, you'll understand why your parents wrestled and said some of the things they did when you're raising your own teenagers. Because sometimes there's just a part of us that feels stronger and more confident than we should. And trying to convince somebody, this young man, you know what, he just thinks no big danger here. I'm just going to head out. It says, passing along the street near her corner, and he took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. Interesting how much of that happens under the cover of darkness. And there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. And she was loud and rebellious, and her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. And she caught him and kissed him. I got to tell you, I just want you to think of that scenario for a minute. This guy is out there, and this woman is dressed in such a manner as to look provocative, to look attractive. And a woman grabs a young man like that, she grabs him and she kisses him. I'm telling you, this guy's already in for big trouble. It is going to be hard to make a good, conscious decision. When we deal with the high school class, I've got a class that I teach, and we deal with sexual temptation and things of that nature. And I actually put a graph up on the board because it's easy to get high schoolers to understand some things. So I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to tell me what clearly, biblically is wrong before marriage. And the high schoolers will always answer that question without any problem at all. Whether they want to practice it or not, they will tell you, fornication. There's nobody in the class that has ever said, I don't think fornication is wrong. I think fornication is okay. Because we'll turn to Thessalonians and other places, there's no danger in not being able to convince somebody that God says that fornication is wrong. So I said, all right, what clearly is not wrong? What level of physical touch in your mind clearly is not wrong? What is acceptable? And almost invariably, they will decide nobody would have a problem with holding hands. Now, I'm not saying nobody would. I'm just saying they've determined that nobody would. I had a professor in college that at FC, as a matter of fact, that was diametrically opposed to linking pinkies, is what he called it. And until you were married, you had no business linking pinkies. You know, most of the kids didn't agree with him, but here's what I do with the kids. I said, all right, now, almost as a chart, almost looking at it like a speedometer, we've got an arrow on the board. There's a host of things between here and here. How do you decide where you're going to stop? Because if it starts with holding hands, then it may be hugging or putting your arm around somebody, and it may be kissing, and then it may be passionately kissing, and then it just keeps going. There may be a matter of touching each other. It can just keep getting worse and worse before the act of fornication itself. How do you decide where you're going to stop in here? The idea is such that, like this young man, you better stop when you can consciously make a decision rather than emotionally make a decision. And wherever along that path, if you are stirred passionately, you have lost your ability to reason at the same level as before you are stirred passionately. I don't care where that is. If holding hands gets you excited and you're stirred up about that, then I would tell you, you better let go, because you can't make a decision consciously and effectively when your passions are stirred as you can when your passions are not stirred. So wherever that is, I mean, I can't identify for all these kids and say, here's exactly where you have to go, and you can't go beyond that. But I want them to understand God talks about passion. This young man was kissed. What's his chance of making right decisions from that point? He's already got himself in a pickle. But then it goes on to say what? It says, with an impudent face, she said to him, I have peace offerings with me. Today I've paid my vows, so I came out to meet you diligently to seek your face, and I have found you. I've spread my bed with colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not home. There you go. We got the rationalization we need. We've got the justification. We've got the protection that is there, the secrecy that we've got that is promised there. We know when he's coming home. He took a bag of money with him. He'll come home on the appointed day. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately, he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter. or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. He followed that pattern absolutely exactly. There's no question about that. This is a man that put himself in a position he shouldn't have put himself in. He listened to things that he shouldn't have listened. He endured and was out under the cover of darkness and just kind of flirting with the side of life that he shouldn't have been flirting with. And all of a sudden he finds himself involved and it ends up catching him in the snare. Well, four things that God says immediately following that are the solution to that problem. Here's what they say. Now, therefore, listen, my children. This is where he's going to start. He says, there's the scenario. Let me tell you how to stay out of that. Because that's what I'm looking to do. I'm not looking as to how to get out of that. I'm looking how to stay out of that. And that's what he's going to do. He says, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. One, he says, guard your heart. Look what he says. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. You better guard the way you think to begin with. You better change the way you think. What affects the way we think? What we see. What a huge factor. I grew up in Florida. And as I mentioned this morning, I spent almost all my time on the water. I wasn't a Christian. And spent almost all my time on the water, at beaches, in boats, whatever the case may be. After I became a Christian, I had a lot to learn about who I really was and what my weaknesses were and what they weren't and things like that. And so I can tell you that at that time, when I was a young Christian, I would have stood and without any hesitation, without any shame at all, have made a defense for the fact that I could look at these women parading by in bikinis all day long and it'd have no effect on my thought process because I had decided that I was going to think differently or do differently than that. Who did I think I was kidding? You can't look at a woman with her clothes off or mostly off and it not affect the way you think. It starts to condition you to certain things. You start to look at people differently. You get your eyes like David did, affixed on somebody because there's an attraction there. I've got to guard my heart. I need to make sure that I'm thinking the right things. It may be a matter of the movies that I watch. What am I going to focus on? What do I dwell on? Even watching television. I remember early on going to Ralph and Paula Walker's house after they were married, Judy and I were married. And I remember he had a verse on a scripture on his television set. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. And he just had it up in the corner of his TV, but it was large enough that you could see from the sofa. It was Job 31:1. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why should I look upon a young woman? I thought, that's a great verse for a TV set. Because we certainly understand today that there are things on TV that we ought not be watching, period. They're just things. It isn't just because it's on prime time that it becomes acceptable to us. We need to make sure that I understand that I'm more vulnerable than I may think that I am. That's why Jesus said, "I'm telling you, if you even look on somebody lustfully." So how do you do that? Guard your heart. Put yourself in a position that I'm not going to allow myself to think those kinds of ways. I need to understand that there are dangers there. I guard my heart because I genuinely understand that there is a danger there. And I want to try and bring every single thought into captivity. One man said, the problem is always, always between the ears. And that's the case. If you don't change your mind first. In Philippians, Paul talks about joy and contentment in life. And he talks about a lot of things. You know, that's where Paul says, hey, you know what? Those are amazing passages. I mean, Paul says, I'm in prison. This is great. You know, you ever thought about that? You ever been in the hospital and thought, you know what? Thank you, God. I can't believe how fortunate I am to be in the hospital laid up like this because I'd have never met that nurse or doctor, never would have had a chance to tell them about you if I hadn't have been in this hospital bed. Thank you for that. Paul said, I'm joyful. He was content even though he was in prison because he thought in terms of opportunity for God. But if you'll read through the book of Philippians, what you'll find over and over again is Paul talks about our mind. Over and over again, he talks about our mind. Because the idea is you've got to have the change of mind first if you're going to overcome the things of the world. That's the way it is here. He's saying guard the way you think, your heart. the place of your feelings in your life. Make sure that you're guarding that and protecting that in this life. Maybe sometimes just not using the circumlocutions like affair. You know, we do that with a lot of words, don't we? We don't talk about death very often. We'll talk about people passing and a lot of other things. We don't say death very much. Why? Because it's a hard word. People don't like the hardness of the word, and so we soften. That's a circumlocution, it's called. Maybe we ought not ever be talking about affair. Maybe we ought to be talking about violating one's covenant with God and one's spouse. Maybe we ought to talk about the infidelity or the adultery or the fornication that is involved in this, being unfaithful to my promises to my spouse or to my God. Secondly, you need to watch your step. This is an issue of where I'm going to go. Look what he says. Do not stray into her paths. Don't go there. This is the passage that would tell you, you know what? I have to tell you here, this really amazes me. We've got Christians at Nashua, and I assure you we are no different than anybody else. We've got Christians at Nashua that have taken their children, who are younger children, 8, 10, 12 years old, and watched R-rated movies with their children. Now, this just boggles my mind, but I would tell you that happens across the board in congregations of God's people. That first off, I got a big issue for most of the adults watching an R-rated movie. If the MPAA industry is saying nobody under 17 should even be watching this without supervision, and God says, you know what, our minds ought to be childlike in that sense, and we're striving for innocence, then we need to be more careful than we are. You better watch the kinds of movies you're watching. Watch the kind of TV you're watching. Watch your step. Guard where it is that you're walking, the kinds of magazines that you look at. One man said, I changed the path I drove to work. Why? Because he happened to normally drive right by a place that had flashing lights and was advertising nude dancers and things like that. He said, you know what? I got tired of seeing that because I just thought I that's going to impress me at some point. It's going to make a difference. I don't need to bombard myself with that thought. He said, I changed my route driving to work. That's a good idea. That's what he needed to do. How do I think in terms of that? It may be a matter of changing my friends. You know, it may be a matter of changing my job. If it's going to lead me away from my wife. Where do you think the two biggest arenas of sexual temptation are in men's lives? I'm sorry, what? Work, number one. Where do you think the other one is? There you go. Work and internet are the two biggest arenas of temptation. The workplace is a major source. People are meeting people. How do you guard your step? I remember when I first started preaching the gospel, Buddy Payne, and several people here probably know Buddy. Buddy came up to me, and this is another incident where I thought, here's another guy who doesn't trust me. You know, because Buddy says, Mark, let me just offer you a piece of advice. Never study with a woman alone, period. And I'm thinking, what does he think I'm going to do? But I felt kind of like the disciples when Jesus said, let down your net on the other side. Because I took the attitude, and Judy and I were already married, I took the attitude and said, if Buddy is telling me that, there has to be a reason. I'm going to respect him because I had that much respect for Buddy. And so I said, I'm not going to do it. Can't even tell you how thankful I am. I have had more than one preacher friend who has fallen victim to sexual temptation because of a woman that he was trying to study with or comfort or counsel in the privacy of just the two of them. I had another friend that fell victim to that just about 6 or 8 months ago. Just absolutely got... and I'm talking about a preacher friend who got involved in that kind of thing. I need to watch where I'm at in the workplace. Anybody heard of the book by Jerry Jenkins? It's called Hedges. Write that title down. Hedges. Loving Your Marriage Enough to Protect It. Every man should read that book. Every man should read it. Some men are going to say, I don't know, I think he's getting a little overboard. He's getting a little carried away here. But it is a book about protecting yourself and your marriage. It is the book that tells you, it's Hedges, Loving Your Marriage Enough to Protect It. It's a book that talks about, you know what, don't put yourself in that environment. Don't meet alone with somebody. He talks about hedges like don't hug somebody. I've got a friend that got involved in an extramarital relationship that started with an over-under handshake. You ever see anybody that's an over-under handshaker? He was that kind of person. That's when you reach out and you shake hands. He shakes hands with women. He would typically shake hands. You turn your hand over this way while you put your other hand on top. and you stand there talking to the person, holding them like this. The particular girl that he did that with on one occasion was very vulnerable. Her marriage was not going the way that she wanted to. She asked, could she talk to him again some other time? They started talking together. They ended up having an extramarital relationship. His marriage dissolved because of it. I'm telling you, you need to plant hedges. The way we hug, the way we embrace, the people we're with. When I was in secular work in Florida, I had to have lunch meetings with people sometimes. Other people have to do that, I understand. I would call Judy. If I had to go to lunch and I knew it was going to be a woman at lunch that I was having to meet, even if there were going to be other people there, it first off, made sure it was always in a public and open place in the restaurant if that's what we were going to do. And then I would call Judy and say, hey, we've got a lunch meeting at Applebee's today. You can't really participate in the meeting, but you know what would really make me happy? Is if I could look across from the table where I'm at and see you, maybe, and one of your friends sitting there having lunch. That would just excite me to be able to see you there today. That did two things. One, it provided a level of protection for me. It allowed me to say, you know what, I know there's an accountability there. But secondly, it provided security for her so that she knew. There was never a case, never a chance that somebody was going to say, hey, I saw Mark at lunch today. Mark was sitting across the table from some woman who was pretty attractive. And then Judy had to say to me, hey, I heard you were at lunch today. It wasn't going to happen. If I was going to have lunch, I called her first and said, here's the scenario. Here's what's going on. Would love to see you there. Whatever it took, planting hedges around your marriage, guarding your step at work, because that's where most people fall first, because that's where we have the most conversations. That's where we get the most emotionally involved. But secondly, the internet. This is a problem, and I was telling Larry earlier today, and I'm not trying to get you to look at anybody or accuse anybody or anything else of that type or wonder what's going on, but I'll tell you, it'd be highly unlikely in an audience of men this large that internet pornography is not something that somebody struggles with. I wouldn't have used to told you that until you start reading more and more of the statistics and more of what is involved. I was counseling in 7 marriages at one time about 4 years ago. Not all of them from my congregation or from our congregation. I was studying with 7 different couples at one time. Of those 7 couples, 5 involved internet pornography. Of those 5, 3 got involved in extramarital affairs, and of those 3, 2 dissolved their marriages. Men are involved in this. There was a Promise Keepers convention a few years ago where they polled the men who were there. Now, this is an organization that is based solely for the purpose of protecting their marriages and families. That's the purpose of the organization. The question was asked of the men in attendance. How many here have been involved with internet pornography within the last 30 days? Not anybody who's ever been involved or seen it. How many have been involved in the last 30 days? 53% of those that were there responded that they had been involved in the last 30 days. 44% of all college males are involved in internet pornography. Think about that total. 44% of all college males at some level are involved in that issue. It is a huge issue. Why? Why is it as gigantic as it is? Easy. It is easy. I mean, and it doesn't even have to be intentional to start it, does it? It doesn't have to be intentional. It's not only easy, it's what? Secret, we think. Private, we think. It's not really. Got a friend that was actually a deacon in our congregation years ago that not only thought that he was being private and secret, thought he was safe in all of that, and was not. His marriage is now dissolved because of it. He's one of the ones that I'm talking about. But not only was his marriage dissolved because of the nature of the pornography that he had, they found it on his computer where he thought he had gotten rid of all of it, and he became arrested because of it as well, because of sending things back and forth to other people as well. Thought he had erased every bit of it off. It's not as easy to get rid of as some people think. The FBI and others have ways of getting that off of your computer. It becomes an issue. Privacy and the easiness, how simple it is to get involved in, becomes a problem. Here's what I would tell you. How many of you in here have got internet access? I mean, it'd be pretty unusual that we don't have internet access, right? How many of you got internet access on your own computer? In other words, you've got it at your own house or whatever. How many of you have what you consider to be a very good, strong internet filter specifically for that reason? See, that's typically what happens when I ask that question. And so one hand goes up. I used this phrase at one congregation, and one of the elders came up to me and said, appreciate that phrase so much. Some people think it's over the top. I'm just telling you, you're losing or have lost your senses if you do not get an internet filter and think that it's not a danger, either to you or somebody else on your computer. You need an internet filter that protects you from going to those sites, that protects your children from going to those sites. One of my good friends had one of his children doing a report for school and was looking for an image of something, clicked on Google Images and got hooked on pornography because of whatever word he had typed in, there were images. I typed in, before I got my filter, I typed in hug for one of our marriage seminars one time. I just thought, well, let me see if I can just find a picture for the book that we put together of a couple just kind of giving a hug or something. The very first picture that popped up under Google Images was two people hugging. They were completely nude. Google does not filter the images for you. That's why something like Be Secure, if you want an internet filter, Be Secure is a very solid, it's by the American Family Association. You can get it from besecure.com. There are besecurehome.com, but either way you'll find it. There are others that are out there that are similar to that. Be Secure won't even allow me to go to Google Images. Can't even go to it at all. If I click on Google Images, it just says site block. You want to find an image, then find an image by going through the website that has the image, not through Google Images. Go through the website because the website may be more, maybe filtering, as opposed to Google not filtering the images themselves. So it drives me that direction. That becomes very important. Is it inconvenient? Yeah, it's inconvenient sometimes. It makes it harder. I have to search a little harder for some of the things that I want, but I'm willing to do that to protect myself, to protect the people that come into my home, to protect the security of my wife. You want to talk about something that will destroy your wife's self-esteem more than anything else? It is a man who views internet pornography. It does not matter if he's pleased with his wife. It doesn't matter if he finds her attractive. She will never feel he does. How many people saw the movie Fireproof? There was a great line in there. I don't know if you remember as it was talking, but as they were having an argument on one occasion, she asked him, "What is it that is so unappealing about me that makes you go there to see that?" That's not, he wouldn't have said that. I mean, this was a very attractive woman by the woman who portrayed her in the movie. You know, that's not the issue. The issue is that it becomes a very addictive behavior. Watch your step. The internet is extremely dangerous. It's wonderful, but it's dangerous. Thirdly, consider the cost. I would just ask you this. When you think of David's situation, imagine talking to David and saying, "David, she is gorgeous." Because I got a feel, based on what David saw, Bathsheba was pretty good looking. So if you sat David down and said, "David, no question, man, she is gorgeous. And you can have her if you want to have her. And the only thing it's going to cost you is the two of you are going to have a son together and he's going to die because you take her and she's not yours. Your own family is going to rebel against you and is going to fight against you, and your own son is going to have to die at the hands of your own soldiers in war with you because you have chosen to do this very thing. You're going to have other things that are going on in your children and your grandchildren. There's going to be great disruption and rebellion in your family because you do this thing. What do you think, David? You want to do it?" What do you think David's response would have been? I'm thinking David says, "No way." Why would you think David would say no way? Too high a price. And what do we know about David as far as his character? He was a man after God's own heart. If David had considered the cost, some of the commercials I love, although they're painful to watch, man, there's one that's put out. You ever seen that little girl on the tire swing that's swinging out in front of her house? And it's got her name and it says 4 years old or whatever else. The next picture, the tire swing's swinging, there's no little girl on it. It's got a second date underneath it that says killed by a drunk driver. I got to tell you, that is a consequential commercial. It's saying, look, you better consider there are costs to drinking and getting behind the wheel. I love that commercial. I love the commercial where they start throwing out body bags in front of the tobacco company. That's a great commercial. They're just pitching them out saying, look, there's consequences involved in this behavior. Understand that. You know, in my generation, it was, "This is your brain." Anybody remember that commercial? "This is your brain on drugs," and they're frying the eggs in the skillet. There's consequences. Consider the cost. Understand what it's going to cost. Think about what it cost David. In Proverbs chapter 6, it says, "Can a man scoop fire into his lap without clothes being burned? Without being scorched? Can any of that happen?" Without his feet being scorched, so is he who sleeps with another man's wife. No one who touches her will go unpunished. There is a cost involved in all of that. It's interesting. One man who preaches, his name was Dave Stone. He used to keep on his desk at his office at the church building where he was, kept on his desk a picture of his wife, a picture of the congregation, not the building, a picture of the people, the congregation, and a news article from the town where he was of a preacher who had given into an adulterous relationship and had caused the destruction of the congregation and the destruction of his marriage. He said, I can just look at those three things on my desk at any given time and understand it is not worth it. It isn't worth it. Consider the cost of all of that. We need to understand there's an unbelievable tragedy involved. It costs children. It costs both of the spouses. It costs other people. It is a cost way beyond what we think that it may be. And then finally, keep the home fires burning. You know, that idea, like we said, the grass is greener where it's watered. Water it at home. Think about it that way. I love what God says when he tells us in Proverbs chapter 5. He says, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. May your fountain be blessed and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. Says you want one of the greatest ways to really prevent an extramarital relationship from coming into your life? He says, here's what I'm telling you to do. You put 100% into being the loving husband that God says you should be and appreciating your wife for the gift that she is and focusing on the gift that she is so that I am ever captivated, because if I truly, every day of my life, focus on the fact that I am married to the most wonderful, the most gracious, the most beautiful woman that I could ever be given by God, I am far less likely to look in other direction. It's when I stop giving attention to this and I grow familiar with this that I might start looking in other directions. It's the same thing that causes us to stray from God. If I would focus every day of my life on what a great God I serve and what an awesome God and what a gracious God He is and how it's the most important relationship to me and nobody has ever done for me what God has done for me and nobody will ever do for me what God will do for me, why would I be tempted to go another direction? I think God just says, be careful. Don't put yourself in a position where that kind of thing can happen. I would leave you with this. I was preaching the same series, the same lesson in Denver, Colorado. A gentleman came up to me afterwards and he said, I'm just telling you, you're way overboard on this. He said, it is just not that dangerous that I have to act like it could happen at any moment in my life. He said, I have determined I will never have an extramarital relationship. And I said, I got to tell you, that's great that you've determined that. What are you putting in place to make sure it happens? Because God warns us about that. He says, don't make a provision in Romans. He says, don't make a provision for the fulfillment of the lust of the flesh. Don't give it a chance. I said, what are you doing? What are you putting in place? What hedges have you planted? He said, I'm not planting hedges. I've just made my mind up that I will not commit adultery on my wife. I didn't even get to make my next statement. One of the other gentlemen from the congregation walked up and he just joined the conversation. I had only met him just a few moments before. He said, I would have fallen asleep with the other disciples. Now, I tell you, at first I thought, that's just kind of a strange comment to make based on what we're talking about. And so I just kind of looked at him, and the other guy looked at him even more curiously, I guess, than I did. He says, what are you saying? He says, I would have liked to have thought that when Jesus told me, watch and pray, I would have watched and prayed. When Jesus came back and said, could you not stay awake? He said, I'd like to have thought, I'll stay awake. Jesus told him to watch and pray because he said, you need to put something in place in order to keep from falling to the weakness of the flesh. Because what he told him was, when he came back, he said what? He said, the spirit is willing. He says, you can determine in your mind all you want to, but you better acknowledge that we are weak creatures of the flesh. And if you don't put something in place And that's all this gentleman was saying. He's saying, you know what? I preached just this last week. We're doing the last 24 hours of the life of Christ in a whole series of lessons, hour by hour, what's going on in his life. And when you watch those things like Peter denying Christ, isn't there a part of you that would like to say, that would not have been me. I would not have been denying Christ when that rooster crowed. It wouldn't have been me. But you know what I have to really admit? It would have as likely been me as it was Peter. Who do I think I am that I am just immune to this danger that is there? God says, guys, you better admit that when it comes especially to sexuality, we are highly driven, and therefore there is an automatic danger of weakness of the flesh. And you cannot control it by mind only. You can control it by putting the things in place so there is no provision for it to be fulfilled. And there is no question in my mind to this day that had Judy's father not had the rules that he had, that, and I'm not saying we would have gotten sexually involved, but there's no question in my mind that because of the rules that he had, he prevented some dangers that would have been there had he not had the rules. I believe that. I'm not so naive as to think, you know, I was so strong during that time, I wouldn't have been tempted to have a relationship with her beyond what I should have had in the privacy of that house when her father was sound asleep. We just sometimes think we're too strong. It's the idea of make sure you plant those hedges around you. That becomes a critical thing. And the greatest hedge of all that you can plant, appreciate and love your wife every day. Tell her what a joy she is to you, what a blessing she is to do. Thank God every day for bringing you this gift of your wife. That's a great thing. And I'm telling you, pray for that and thank God verbally, out loud, when you're praying with your wife. Because not only will you express appreciation to God, you create an incredible sense of security and good feeling and will in your wife as well, when you're telling God how much you appreciate who she is and what she is in your life. God says, plant hedges. Don't make provision. Protect yourself. It's dangerous. Internet and work are the two areas you're going to find you're going to have to work the hardest. Certainly appreciate everybody's attention. I know we went a couple minutes over on that, but it just is one of those lessons that scares me to death. I would ask you this before we dismiss this class. How many of you know somebody who has been guilty of an extramarital relationship? How many of you know a Christian that's been guilty of an extramarital relationship? And the hands virtually all stay the same, don't they? How many of you know a Christian who's been guilty of an extramarital relationship whose marriage has been severed because of it? Does that not scare you? That shouldn't be happening amongst God's people. I mean, the world may deal with that. We shouldn't be dealing with it if the numbers we're dealing with it. We need to understand this is a bigger danger than we think that it is. Don't become one of those statistics. Make sure that you do everything you can to protect your marriage. It is worth protecting, not only for you. Here's the thing David did. You remember what David was faulted for? Nathan the prophet went and saw David. And what did Nathan the prophet say to David? Do you remember? He said, you're going to lose your son, David. Why are you going to lose your son? Absolutely. He said, because you've given the enemy a chance to blaspheme the name of God. That's what David did. He forgot who he was. People were going to say something about his God because of what he did. Not just David. Because of his God. I used to ask my boys when they'd leave the house. They'd get ready to leave when they were teenagers. I said, what's your name? They looked at me like I was loony. I said, what's your name? And whichever one was going out, Matthew would say, my name's Matthew, you know, until he caught on. My name's Matthew. I said, well, I understand it's Matthew. What's your whole name? He'd say, it's Matthew Adam Broyles. I said, I want you to understand something. My name's Broyles too. Every time you walk out of the house, you take my name with you. You don't only cause people to look at you, you cause people to look at me. Every day I walk with the name of Christ, I cause people to reflect on the name of God and the name of Christ. David missed that point. He lost his son because he gave occasion to the enemy to blaspheme. We need to do everything we can, whatever effort it takes, to make sure that we do not give the enemy the opportunity to blaspheme the name of God because I can't remain true to my promise to my wife and to my God. Thank you guys so much for your attention. I don't think there's anything else that we need to have or other than a closing prayer. In just a minute, Jacob's going to lead us in closing prayer. But we're going to have classes tomorrow. It's 9:30 tomorrow, right? Regular time of your services. A key lesson in the morning where we're going to talk, and really the key lesson of the ones so far that we've talked about for those that aren't married yet. So if you can be here for the Bible class tomorrow, a couple of points in particular that are very beneficial and helpful in that. And then we're going to talk about what I think to be the most important of all the lessons at the Sunday morning regular sermon time. So we'll have our closing prayer.